fascist states in developed society. There's no other words to describe it.
Noam Chomsky, world-renowned political dissident, linguist, and author, laureate professor in the Department of Linguistics at the University of Arizona and professor emeritus at Massachusetts Institute of Technology, where he taught for more than 50 years. Next week, we'll bring you more of Noam Chomsky. That does it for our broadcast. If you'd like to get our newsletter daily, text the word Democracy Now! To 66866. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Libby Rainey, Nermeen Sheikh, Carla Wills, Tammy Warrenoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. Thanks so much for joining us. Stay safe, save lives, wear a mask.
Listening to KBOO Portland,
where it is 8 a.m. and this is your reminder, your weekly reminder on a Friday mornings at 8 to mind the gap, because girls are powerful. Stay tuned to your community connection.
Good morning, Portland and the world. You're listening to KBOO here on your local connection. I'm Tammy. Excuse me. I'm Tammy. And I swear I know how to talk. On the line with me is the virtuous, amazing Althea Billings. How are you doing, Althea?
Hello, virtuous.
Yeah, it's true.
Hi, Tammy.
You're grown now, you know, so you're moving on to that plateau.
Yeah.
And
onwards and upwards.
Only when we lay, when they aim low. And
exactly.
In the air room is the one and only Sonia. Give it up, everyone. Thank you, y'all, for joining in, and thank you to the listeners for tuning in on the web, kboo.fm, or on your terrestrial signal, 90.7 on your FM dial. So this is the gap. Reminding it, we're bridging it, you know, just giving it attention, not neglecting it. And today, I wanted to answer questions that I keep getting from people, not just like, you know, East Coast folks or people in the South, actually like from around the world. And they want to know, what's the deal with Portland, Oregon? That's my Seinfeld impression, just like with all the protests and stuff. Thank you. I was waiting for that last one. But it is very serious, and everyone is really wondering, like, really, what's going on in Portland? And obviously people on cable have been covering it, from the, you know, news department to other talk radio shows to, like, a lot of the public affairs programs. And it's also on the social media, on the Instagram and stuff. There's been a cable presence. Yeah, I just wanted to take a moment to talk about it, since we are here and there is, like, pretty much an international eye looking at our cute town, and all of the, well, groundbreaking things that are happening when it comes on the front of, you know, protesting and what that means and the legalities and what's that word? Oh, yeah, tyranny. So there's a couple of fronts that I want to talk about it with you. I know we spoke about it yesterday about, I mean, so many different questions. And mostly, I wanted to, well, let's just start off talking about this article that I sent you by a local, actually, was it Robert Evans, I think, from Behind the Bastards. They wrote a article that was basically like giving a timeline of what's going on, what has been going on in Portland, and basically how it escalated to the point that we are here. But in the article, much like I'd say like 80% of the, you know, news coverage about this, it made it seem the word like war zone was in the title, and different aspects like that describing the situation in the area and the uprising and the peaceful protest as a war zone, you know. And I got a couple of issues with that, and I'm not the only one. And Althea, you when I mentioned this, you said something, if you'd like to give us a snippet about it.
Yeah. Well, about it. To clarify where we're going with this, is that war zone and characterizing this conflict in that context sort of both obviously like undermines the cause and the ability to talk like, you know, in a complex way about what people are asking when they're out on the streets, but it also, you know, obscures some of the abuses that we're seeing that are going on in the streets right now. In saying that something is a war zone, this idea of when you see these pictures of federal law enforcement in military fatigues, like that is not something that we typically see in an American city taking action against American citizens. It's been a couple decades since action like that has been on the level of visibility that it is right now. But
I'd like to highlight Baltimore, because the tanks were called in Baltimore. I would just say on top of that, a predominantly white city, because also
sure.
So I would just have to correct you on that one, man. But yeah, totally agree with you. Keep going.
And just that, you know, the idea of like, I think back to like a month ago when the conversation about police inciting violence at protests had a lot to do with tear gas and rubber bullets and impact munitions, and that there was significant both legislative and legal action taken to try to keep the police from doing that to people. And now, obviously, we're on a whole other level with, you know, federal agents who are not clearly identified pulling people off the street into unmarked vans without probable cause. And that is horrifying and definitely like a big deal, but in contextualizing what this is as a war zone, it makes it seem okay. And that's one thing that
like
I worry
a lot. Soldiers.
Yeah, that both sides, that, you know, you see that this is the way that the feds are dressed, but like what are the protesters wearing and what kind of weapons do they have, and that it makes it seem like there's some level of equal power on both sides, and equal harm being done. And that's something that's not accurate, and I think makes it so that people can't deal with the issue in a complex way, and it obscures, you know, the real problems with taking away people's First Amendment rights to assembly and to freedom of speech and to, you know, transparent, as far as we've got it, a transparent justice system where if you get arrested, you got to know what for. Yeah.
And by
I also,
whom?
Right. There is that. There was a well taken point from The Daily Show that I saw that was saying that, you know, in the U.S., there are wear camo and carry around the types of weapons that the feds are carrying around in Portland right now. Like, how do you tell if you're being arrested or if you're being kidnapped? People like to cosplay as the feds. And how do you handle yourself in that situation?
Yeah, when I was gathering some audio for the show, I you know, looking at the videos, and it would make for very good radio, because frankly they are they're not the, the regular folks that were arresting people beforehand. These people seem, again, from the footage, a lot more composed, well put together, and focused. There's a lot of focus. They aren't, you know, talking back to people. They're just grabbing them and putting them into a really fancy Ford Charger with Florida plates. And it's, like you said, kind of terrifying because, you know, this is, you know, America, and people like their A2s and the ARs, and like they're, you know, they like to cosplay. So now you have these people and they aren't identifying themselves. And if they are, I do want to say that I did see that in some of the footage, the soldiers had police written on the front and the back of their vest. But it's like, but to say it's no police I've seen, you know, as a veteran, I can tell you they look a little bit more veteran, a little bit more familiar, but as a civilian, no, that's not something, you know, like you said, that you see on a day to day in a place like Portland. And gosh, it was pretty, just seeing the videos, it was pretty terrifying. But it's not terrifying as though you're watching a war movie where you have two sides got a tank or one side is using guerrilla warfare. It's more of like just people getting snatched off the street and their friends saying, don't worry, we got you, we'll reach out to the, you know, to this defense. I mean, they're just dropping all these acronyms like, don't worry, this and this got you, or we'll call them, or we'll do this. So there is action being done. So I want to, you know, at least let people know that, you know, because you don't see these people like walking out of jail or, you know, being dismissed. So, you know, that there are people and they are coming out. I don't know about all of them, but definitely at least the two that I followed up on. And that brings, you know, so many different questions as to like, why is it being reported like this? And how, you know, where, as, you know, media outlet here at Cable, I wonder, like, how can a person who, how can you understand the nuances of what's been going on here if you aren't from here, you know? And then if you are from here, at least while all of this is happening, not fairly born and raised, how can you do right by what's happening, and, you know, or at least do right by the truth? You know, I think calling a war zone is, well, in a way, it's kind of racist. It's kind of racist because I just want to know what law was broken. You know, like how is this a war zone? So, you know, Rob, I mean, I don't know if you're listening, you know, feel free to call. I'm just saying, Rob, I'm not good on you. I'm just very interested as to why you decided to use these words. And I have to always remind myself in everything that I read and I see these days, I have to remind myself, we are also very close to November. So you never know, you know, what, like, motives people have when they report on this. Not necessarily, like, local ones, like, you know, like Rob or anything. I'm just saying the larger outlets, how you called it, parachute journalism, when they parachute in from out of town. And they, was it the black journalist?
I have it for you. It's this document that we've been looking at in the Cable newsroom, and a bunch of different places have been talking about. It's called Journalism for Black Lives, and it was put together by the group Free Press Action and the Movement for Black Lives, and you can find it online if you're interested. But it's a document talking about, like, instructions for journalists when thinking about covering issues like Black Lives Matter and protests, and how it's important what kind of how you go about it, and in this particular instance, framing. So I'm gonna read you a little passage. Many frames used in conventional storytelling are anti-black and have been a critical tool for the forces of black oppression. Today's journalists must cast a critical eye on those typical frames. Here are a few to watch out for. And the first one that they talk about is themes of war and looting. So it instructs journalists to saying, avoid using terms like war zone and soldiers to describe the people and places where uprisings are happening. This moves the story away from the truth of how violence has been introduced into the situation by a police murder of black folks like George Floyd, and also via militarized police forces rolling into communities to shut down freedom of speech and protest. These areas are not war zones. They are communities and neighborhoods occupied by an aggressive force seeking to maintain order, otherwise known as the white racial caste system.
Yeah.
Not to put too fine a point on it.
Oh, go ahead. What did you say, Sonia?
Not to put too fine a point on it.
But I think that it also, considering like the history and the way that black-related like uprisings or, you know, protests resulting in violence against black people, it always gets this narrative of war zone. In Baltimore, it was a war zone. In L.A., it was a war zone. So that's it's so great to know, like, people are thinking about, you know, just providing all these resources and explaining to you why this is not, you know, not okay, basically. I love that explanation.
And that, as you know, because, and this is something that I often try to talk to the people in my life who have, you know, valid skepticism about the way that, you know, news media treats certain subjects, because it isn't necessarily like an individual bad actor who's like trying to get you the wrong information. There is a lot of that out there. But we're also talking about people who are on deadline, who are now, you know, not relying on newspaper sales, which were steady and people had subscriptions to that they could rely on that income. They're looking for more sensational stuff. They want to get clicks. And it's not necessarily that they're wrong to want to get clicks, but in really sensitive situations like talking about, you know, protest uprisings for racial justice, going with a more sensational lens and saying that it's a war zone does, you know, obscure things and sets the movement backwards. I will say that, and that's not, you know, the fault of anyone involved with trying to advocate for change. I will say, you know, to say that things have gotten a little bit better, it seems at least in a section of the country, like the George Floyd related protests have pushed beyond somewhat the good and bad protester narrative.
Mm-hmm.
The sort of continuous gripes about property damage that there is, while it may not be a nuanced lens that a lot of people are looking at the idea of vandalism, there is like a sense that it doesn't necessarily condemn what it is you are trying to advocate for if you engage in vandalism.
There was, it seemed, a full-on campaign to explain that broken windows don't equal, like, killing, thinking about it in like, a meme
way. Yeah,
I'm seeing the meme.
There's another point on the Journalism for Black Lives document that talks about don't equate, like, property damage to, like, loss of life. Those things mm-hmm. are nowhere near on the same scale, but that's the kind of thing that can happen when you have, like you mentioned, people engaging in parachute journalism where they're not involved in the community, they're looking for sources, and you get, you know, some small business owner with gripes about how, you know, a window was broken or somebody set their dumpster on fire or something like that. It's not as clear a picture as journalists who are in the community and have like reliable sources of information.
Yeah, every you know, city and every government, it's like high school, you know, there's nuances and people get ostracized and people come back after 2 years thinking that everyone's going to forget that really messed up thing that they did, and then they come back, you know, try to run for different places in office and stuff, so historical knowledge is important. So I'm learning something, especially while being part of a institution that is older than me, that historical knowledge is very important for, you know, preserving a future that doesn't repeat itself. But, you know, going back on the protests and the deployment of the, you know, I don't say secret police or special, I say a special unit, and I will say that, that was created by Homeland Security to quell and protect the statues. The American statues, because that's what they're for, in order to protect the statues. So And you had a question that you said, would it be the same if it was in Chicago or LA? Like, would the reporting be different? Would it be the same, considering like the just the demographics of the city? And it doesn't look different. I mean, excessive use of force seems like excessive use of force to me, you know. But I think that maybe it's maybe getting so much attention, or at least I'd say like nuanced attention, in comparison to, for example, Baltimore, because, and I wonder, is it because most of the faces that you're seeing are white folks? And then, you know, on top of that, you also have like the mayor who came to, for a photo shoot, I mean, protest. And it seemed pretty interesting to see him as a mayor getting, or being in the vicinity of you know, like tear gas, also while being the commissioner of the police. So it's so layered. It's so freaking layered. And I just gave myself a whole
There's a lot. There's a lot of different like angles that you can approach it at. And Tammy and I had discussed this a little bit previously, because Tammy had been expressing that there were people in her life who had been like, oh, what's going on in Portland? Like, what is happening? I'm just hearing these like crazy stories about people getting snatched off the streets, which are true, but that I was trying to kind of like suss out why it is that that's the kind of attention that we were getting. And one of my thoughts is like, maybe people don't like think about Portland that often. It's only like it's the fourth major city on like the West Coast, and do people just remember, you know, like hipsters and beards and beer and bikes? Like, is that what they think is here? Is that what they think that we have going on? And then now all of a sudden it's what's happening in Portland. Portland used to be this like peaceful place where you could be a hipster and go hiking. Like, what is up? But then we kind of reached the point that, you know, if this kind of conflict were seen in another major U.S. city, it would likely be treated a lot different.
I would think so, too. And how do you think it would be treated, like, differently?
I mean, I think there would be a clearer sense of scope in terms of, like, what I've seen, and correct me if you've seen other stuff, but that like there's a sense in characterizing it as a war zone that like the whole city is like under siege or something. And it's not. Like, most neighborhoods are the same as they were, you know, before the feds came in, and that's not, you know, true of all neighborhoods, but protests have been where they've been for the past, you know, month and a half. I forgot what I was going to say after that. I apologize.
Oh, it's okay. The word siege is interesting, because just in talking about how things get reported, not necessarily just the protests, but see, it's interesting because there's definitely a lot more of that word being used in Minneapolis when the station was burnt down. And even when talking about Wendy's, and even what, you know, like the Wendy's was seized and set on fire.
It's so interesting.
Go ahead.
Right. Oh, I was just going to point out that like a siege is something that would have happened to like a medieval city, and it's like that it's so far divorced from that context, I guess, but that we all know what it means. I just think that's interesting. I didn't really have a point to make about it.
It's the usage of words, and it you know, makes me think of Patty Hearst. I mean, or Patty Hearst's daddy. Like, you know, are we going back to yellow journalism? I mean, look, if we have to categorize everything in 120 characters or less, how are we not going back to that? You know, and then you go on all of the media outlets, and you see, or social media outlets, and you see everything through the scope of someone's like of someone's basically their point of view, which is great if you want to be updated, but not if you don't understand what's actually going on the ground, and it can be very misleading. And again, I'm not saying that like things aren't happening here. They totally are happening here, and today will be the 56th day of protesting, and people are like not only are people protesting, but people are actively doing things and getting legislation done behind, like, not even closed door, open doors, you know, like, behind the scenes. Like, you know, I mentioned yesterday, pepper spray when Mr. Wheeler went to the protest the other night, and there was pepper spray or tear gas or pepper spray. I'm not sure. I don't want to. It was one of the two. You know, and it was Don't Shoot Portland, Don't Shoot PDX, who, you know, was basically championing the legislation to get the cops to stop using that excessive type of force. And yet even the mayor / commissioner of the police can't even get that stuff used on him. So, and on top of that, to add to the layer of layered complexity, the person who, like, is the founder of Don't Shoot Portland is the person who was contending against Ted Wheeler in the mayoral election. So, you know, it keeps going and going. And I know we're not even at the segment yet. I know, but I'm just going to say it. Where's the NRA? Where's the NRA at? Where are you at? I want to know where you at.
Yeah.
We've done nothing in the last while besides for petitioning to keep gun stores open during the pandemic. Like, this is what, like, A2, like this is, like, all of these words, like, the Second Amendment, all of these things, like, this is what you've been saying for so long, that this is, you know, this is the one, and I'm not saying, like, you know, I'm not, God forbid, I'm not, like, calling, I'm just asking, a question, where are you at? This has been your mission statement for however long you've been existent, and, you know, and it just makes me wonder. Oh, is it because black people are involved that you don't want to do it? I don't know. I'm just saying. I'm not saying individuals, God forbid, I'm not saying individuals. I've got friends in the NRA, and none of them are white. And they say themselves that when they go out shooting and when they do stuff like that, they have to, like, you know, suss out, like, who is and who isn't, you know, basically white supremacist. So, if that's the general idea or, you know, generalization, stereotype of the organization, and now when the stuff is hitting the fan, where you at? You've been trained for this, you know. I'm just wondering. But don't worry, you think this is, we're gonna, this is not, this is the tip of the iceberg. I have so much to say, and I'm not the only one. There's much smarter, much wiser and well experienced people who have a lot more to say about this, and we'll talk about that in a little bit as well. I want to know where they at. And I went to the website, and they're having like a Portland, meeting around Portland for shooting, and I'm just like, y'all gonna go, like, not even a statement, really? Like, not even something to, like, not a statement? Like, even a general big statement.
Yeah. I just can't get over, like, I think it was the Hard Times headline that said something to the effect of NRA, like, embarrassed, admits that it forgot to rise up against a tyrannical government. Just spaced. Sorry. Sorry, I had my phone off. I totally forgot.
Oh, it's all good.
my notifications weren't on. I forgot to rise up against the tyrannical government.
I just switched to an Android. That's what happened.
Oh, man.
There's.
That's how they get you.
That's how they get you. You know, you got to turn on the notification in order to see them. They don't just pop up. But, yeah, so that's just kind of what's been going on in Portland town, is the chain of events that led to it is basically, you know, minimal things actually happened, like little reforms happened that the protesters, you know, found suitable. You know, there wasn't the defunding. I think at the end there was only a quarter of what the movement wanted to get redirected from the police fund, from the police budget. And that was in the early days. Like, and I can't really quite remember anything happening on the government side since then. Which, I mean, it is something. They did, you know, something was done, but they kept going. The protesters kept going, and I mean, and then, you know, the president said, I mean, we all heard that phone call when he said you gotta get them so that they don't get you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then sent in, I guess, reinforcements, for lack of a better word. And I'm pretty sure Seattle, I read, is they have them a standby for Seattle. So, you know, it's just the beginning. Like, it's the prototype. Like, you got to try it out somewhere before you take it out. So they've been trying it.
He's trying to make an example out of us.
Yeah, perfecting it in the Middle East, and now you're going to bring it back home.
Mm.
But yes, this is a call in radio talk show, and in case you'd like to call in and talk on this here radio show, you can call 503-231-8187.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, 8187. So my personal phone number is very similar, so I'm always scared I'm just going to say my phone number on air.
Don't call Tammy directly.
I mean, you know.
You may not end up on air, unfortunately.
It won't end up on air, but you'll end up on my mind, which is a far more dangerous place to be.
Far more coveted, really.
Aw. Yeah, so that's tough. 503-231-8187. So I already touched the NRA nerve, so I already got myself a little jitterbugged up, and I'm in it like swimwear, and I can't stop. I do have a clip from Vice. We're hitting all the like Portland related sites as things today. Good for us. You have a hard time.
Hello.
Got BE our Evans. Shout out to all the Portland people, the journalists and all, still doing it. It's hard. It's hard, as you can see. I'm doing it with not too much grace, but, you know, thank God we have these folks and people like Althea to balance out people like me, so thank you. So there's a Vice, like, mini doc that they did about a black woman who is a gun owner and also owns the only gun shop in California at the time that they were filming this. We'll hear in the little clip, it's about 2 minutes long, that there, at the time of the video, there are only five black-owned gun shops in all of America, which it's very odd. That's a very strange thing, considering the stereotypes and all. That the media tries to push on, and yet it's very interesting, very, you know, layered, of course. But I want to play that video, and then we will come back and talk about it. Thank you very much, Sonia.
Shoes on the line, concussion check, ready? Count them up, two!
You're going to go hit, bow, bow, and then you're going to move back to create the distance, and then you can push out. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Geneva Solomon is a mother of three and firearms instructor in Los Angeles. She teaches self-defense and shooting skills to a group of black gun enthusiasts and me, a New Yorker who's never touched a gun.
Oh!
Geneva says she didn't grow up around guns, but first turned to firearms for self-defense after leaving a relationship she described as violent.
And so I walked into a gun store, and I'm a black woman walking into a gun store. I was the only one there. And I think I waited about an hour and a half before someone would come and talk to me. And I didn't like that experience at all.
The memory of that experience prompted Geneva and her husband, Jonathan, to open Redstone Firearms. But in the 5 years they've been open, they've dealt with some harassment.
We've had swastikas carved into the windows, cars been keyed, emails have been sent, lots of threatening phone calls.
There's not a lot of black-owned gun shops in the country. It's pretty rare.
We didn't really realize we were that unique. It wasn't until about a year into operating the actual store that I sat down, got on the computer, and realized, oh my gosh, we're one of like five, and we're the only one in California.
Redstone Firearms is registered with the NRA, The organization has a tight grip on the gun industry, offering benefits to business owners like Geneva. Yet Geneva turned to another gun club for a sense of belonging. Its name? The National African American Gun Association, or NAGA. Some call it the NRA for Black people.
Two to the body, one to the head.
The Solomons are NAGA state directors for California.
Shoot it, ready? Shoot!
Dr. Rashid Ivy is one of NAGA's newest members.
I love what NAGA's doing and loved how positive they were, how much they were really devoted to teaching people how to be positive gun owners and changing the stigma in our communities of gun ownership.
Are you also a member of the NRA?
No.
Why not?
The stigma associated with them is that they're race. It's a racist organization.
Black gun owners and the NRA have had a contentious relationship for generations. In 1967, in response to the Black Panther Party legally and openly carrying loaded guns, the NRA actually supported gun control legislation.
So that was, again, the little piece from a Vice doc about the NAAGA and... that little bit piece in the end there, I'd like to talk about it. And just for a second, I just want to give it space. School shootings, they won't, you know, it's all good. They won't, you know, you can't take away the guns. No, tyranny, God forbid. Black people with guns? Oh, no. We gotta rethink this one. So I'm just wondering, like, this is honestly my opinion. Does, like, why... Where are they? Like, what, you know, and I don't know if I don't want to talk about it, like, too much. I don't, you know, I'm not, like, endorsing anything or, posing. I'm just saying, like, if I'm sitting somewhere and all day long I'm saying, I want an apple, and then now there's an apple tree growing in front of me, fresh apples ready for me to pick, and people are kind of like, hey, why aren't you eating these apples? You know, we kind of need you to eat these apples, maybe. I'm okay. So I'm just wondering, and it's like quite frightening because, when other things, and you know, we're talking about the cosplayers, when other things happen, like perhaps, I don't know, people telling you to put on a mask, then that's an infringement on your freedom, but like putting people without identifying yourself into a car with Florida license plates in you know, downtown Portland is okay.
Yeah. No, I don't want to, like, to be clear, we're not, like, trying to say that, like, anybody should come out armed against, like,
oh God, no,
the
I'm
cops
not,
right now.
I'm
like, I want to
no.
clarify that point. But yeah, I mean, it's interesting to have, like, an actual moment to examine, like, the NRA talking out of both sides of its mouth, I guess. Because, you know, the whole history of the Second Amendment, which is what the NRA, you know, is touts and is based on, and, like, wanting to protect the Second Amendment, which gives people the right to bear arms, because at the time of the founding of the U.S., people still had vivid memories of the British taking away their guns and locking them up, and that they weren't allowed to regulate their own communities, and in turn, like, made it harder for them to rise up against their oppressive government or whatever. And that was then enshrined in the Bill of Rights because it was, like, that level of important that we need to be able to have, like, the government does not get... I mean, it's wrong to say that the government doesn't get exclusive use of force, because it gets exclusive legitimate use of force, but I digress. but that's what it's founded on, is, like, this idea that, you know, people can have guns because that will be able to allow people to keep the government in check. And a lot of the arguments against, you know, using the Second Amendment in that way so as to, you know, not try to create, you know, stricter, you know, background checks or stuff like that, is that, you know, the level of weaponry that the government has versus what the people have access to is vastly, you know, outclassed at this point in time versus back in the 1700s when everybody just had muskets, you know? Have musket, will travel. And that there's a lot of different ways that you could look at it. But it is interesting to see this kind of case in point and think about, you know, when people join the NRA, or you see like on TV, they have like shows on TV about like doomsday preppers and stuff, and they always have a large cache of weapons. It's interesting to think about what is the future that you are, what does that future look like? What are you afraid of, and how does this doesn't represent that to you? And I think that should say something.
It speaks a silent, how to do it, like a silent scream. It's just, and then on top of it, another talking point that they are just a pack. And I want to also in a little documentary there, the NAAGA are also turning into a pack. So we see it all the time. How, you know, this group, like, they back up a certain politician, and then, you know, think, I mean, we saw after Orlando, we saw all of the, you know, the mass shooting in Orlando, we saw all these things play out constantly, just constantly, constantly happening. So it's very confusing to me. And you mentioned that, you know, like the preppers, you know, I'm sure that there are, you know, some folks that were, you know, when they heard, oh, quarantining, oh, virus, I'm ready. I've been ready. You know,
mm-hmm.
But I wonder. I don't know, man. It's exhausting to try to think about sometimes, because it's a constant perpetuation of wishful thinking. You know, and mm-hmm. It just makes me. It's hard not to be judgmental, because it's, you know, it's like you see how polarizing things are getting. And you see that only the extremities of both sides are coming out. And because that's why we have, like, how did this escalate to this point? There's still a pandemic. Like, you know, there's still people that are sick, and they're still, like, once the second wave hits, like, it's still going to, like, there's so many things to worry about. And it just makes no sense to me that the resources in a time where we need to, like, I think we need to be, like, unified and try to help each other out. The resources are just all being used to tear us apart, if not literally from our communities by force, you know, into trust with Florida license plates, to just, like, you know, just the propaganda that we see constantly bombasted on the mainstream media. So you know, if there's an organization that claims to do something, and I think a lot of organizations, it's not just NRA, they're showing their true colors, you know, when it comes to, like, where they stand now. But then in the same token, you see all these organizations making statements and putting out statements, and it's just kind of like, you say this, yet you don't, you know, follow what you preach, you know? It's like mm-hmm. when Me Too happened, or when Me Too first was, you know, just started, and, you know, people were, oh, we respect women, and we support all of this and this and that, but meanwhile, there's still, like, not enough women at that workplace, or there's still the gap, you know, the wage gap. We love women so much. What's up with that wage gap? What's up with the racial wage gap?
Yeah. So actions speak louder than words.
The irony, things are just not ironic. They're not ironic anymore. Just as American as apple pie, and it's. I think we can do so much better. You know. How, I don't know at this point. I really don't. But I think that this attention that the cities, that, like, there's, because there's so much attention being put on us, and because, like, the city's going through a lot of, I mean, imagine getting kidnapped by some, like, I don't, like just getting snatched up by someone wearing full paramilitary gear, and then being put into a car. Like, how terrifying is that? That's intifada stuff. That's not American. Like, you know, that's not.
Yeah, and as very little we are prepared to deal with like the criminal justice system and being arrested under normal circumstances for probable cause, how, like, it's hard to even fathom what that would look like.
What is the, if we're allowed to gather constitutionally, allowed to voice our opinion, then how are soldiers putting you in cars? What is this, you know?
Yeah.
And it's really scary. And it's the best wishes and best of luck and like sympathies and all of that, because something like that is something that's gonna take a while for someone to get over. Like how the heck are you supposed to walk out the street and go to work the next day? You're not.
Mm-hmm. I think there's a bit of this that's kind of like, it's kind of implied in most of what's been said about this, but no one has really explicitly said, like, when you've actually broken a law and you're arrested for it, there's a sense of, okay, I got popped. Mm-hmm. When you've done absolutely nothing and you get snatched up, they've already broken the contract there. Someone has already mm-hmm. taken a step beyond what is accepted. And so then there's no knowing what else they're going to do. They've already crossed mm-hmm. a line. There are lines that once someone crosses it, you don't know what else they're going to do. And when that person is an armed federal agent and no one knows who they are and where they're taking you, I mean, come on.
Yeah, how do you expect that to quell things? How do you expect people to be like, okay, yeah, no, you're right, we'll chill out, because that's a measured response to what you said.
Well, I'm just talking about the terror that such a person feels, who's mm-hmm. been abducted that way, and the trauma that they live with afterward.
Mm-hmm.
And I just want to, like, I'm sure, like, you're thinking about this, but, you know, just imagine what so many people in other countries feel where they don't have, like, the constitutional, just, like, you know, just the UN saying, oh, human, here are some human rights, but really, in actuality, these type of things happen constantly in some countries, constantly, like, in different continents and at such volumes and, like, you know, just... it happens constantly in some places. So to, you know, and to think, like, you know, being here, feeling so removed from that, you know, like, it happens in, like, where my mom is from, that happens, it's like nothing that happens there. If you go, you know, you go to college, usually college students, which is what, you know, these kids, they look like kids, you know, it's like high school, maybe college students, you see them and you see them, and then they say something, or they speak up, or they do a project about something they're not supposed to, and you just don't hear from them anymore. And then they're gone, or they get relocated. And, you know, I'm not saying, God forbid, that that's happening here. I have absolute, but if the Constitution is the only thing that's keeping this country from becoming that, then, I don't know, perhaps that little piece of paper over there needs to be, you know, protected and amplified and reiterated, perhaps. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe Nicolas Cage needs to, you know, get it back.
Yeah. Well, and it's the whole kind of, like, the act now, ask questions later, that, like, undoubtedly this will be the subject of litigation for years to come. And while it is, you know, hardly comforting, I'm sure, to the people who've really been through it, like, they'll get a settlement out of the government for it.
Do not be worried about
infringing on people's rights as you're doing it, but instead, I'll pay you, you know, $2 million for those rights.
Interesting. So they know that they I'm guessing that they speculate that there will be a lawsuit and it's just kind of like ask questions later, which is,
well, that's what I would say to people who say, like, how is this legal? It's like, oh, it's not.
Mm.
It's not. There will be, like, a consequence, but it's not changing actions in the moment, you know?
That's a really good point. I want to get back to it. We do have someone on the line. You're there?
Yeah, I am. Good morning.
Hey, how's it going?
Listening a little bit to the things you've been saying. You've touched on a number of points that are pretty important. The last one you just brought up about, you know, we'll worry about the outcome later, the fallout later. Well, this is, I think, a pretty naked ploy by the Trump administration to reinforce their position with their base. And so if Trump stays in office, then that makes it all worthwhile. And if Trump is out of office, then that makes him not responsible for the consequences. The Trump family, his cousin has just written a book. Has just written a book about the dynamics of the family, and they talk a lot about the lack of taking responsibility for anything as being a big motivator. You know, that they're shielded by their wealth and their social position and their lack of emotional rapport with anybody and anything to do what they want to, you know, to gain and hold on to power. So I think this is just another manifestation of that. It's pretty clearly unconstitutional in a lot of ways, although some of the fire-setting behavior is troubling at least, and counterproductive at best. Also, you talked about people being snatched up off the street and whisked away. Well, let's not forget that our country for years has run the School of the Americas, which is a training military and police from largely third world countries in South America to basically have death squads and to exert force and terror against their own populations to support governments that are cooperative with the aims of the United States and the asset acquisitions of the United States. And chew on that one for a while. And I'll just listen off the air, but thanks for your show and thanks for your work.
Thank you so much. Appreciate that.
Thank you, yeah.
School of the Americas, yep. I remember when I first learned about that, it made me think, I was like, this is a conspiracy theory. There's no way that this, but it is. It's a conspiracy. It's just a nations conspiring together and creating this, like just death squads and just like go to different countries. But I guess, you know, you perfect it together, execute it, right?
There has been some, oh, sorry, go ahead.
Okay, we do have another phone caller.
Hello?
Hey, Linda, you're live.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call. You know, as long as Donald Trump is in the White House, nothing is going to be reasonable because he's not a reasonable man. And I am really concerned. I don't know why the majority of the protesters in Portland don't meet somewhere other than the federal courthouse. Okay. And they're just picking a fight with Donald Trump and the feds, and the feds are, you know, going to do what they're going to do. Why not assemble somewhere else that is not federal federal stuff and take away that power from them?
It's a good
and
question.
And then let the hooligans that want to go down there at midnight face their consequences for, you know, setting fires and crap. But the thousands of people or the hundreds of people, why don't they assemble somewhere else and take away that excuse for the federal forces to be here? Because they're going to send federal forces to other cities too. And you know what? When Donald Trump loses the election, he could then just declare federal law. This is a phony election. I've already got the troops on the ground in all the major cities. I'm just declaring federal law because this has been a bogus election.
Hey,
why don't they move away from
right now?
Say again?
Why don't the majority of the protesters move away from the federal courthouse and take away that excuse for the federal agents to be here.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, thank you
Tammy?
So much. That's a legitimate question. The only thing that I can think that comes to mind is the notion, and again, I don't know, this is just my opinion. The only thing, the first thing that comes to mind is because it is federal, it belongs to the people because we are the people. Just a question. I'm not declaring anything. Because there is like a, I think from my understanding and the people that I talk to about this, there is a bit of like a socialist undertone to the themes. And so it's just like taking back the means. I don't know. And also just because it's a Justice Center and it's unjust. Do you know maybe like any facts? This is all my assumption.
Right. Well, Linda is right to point out that the only like quote unquote like legitimate use of federal forces was supposed to be in conjunction with protecting federal property. So the federal property downtown. And so I would say that not all protests have been centered on there. There's been some centered on the police union building. There's been, you know, marches
some
in
of
different
the east
areas.
Side?
It's just
very peaceful and very, yes, go ahead.
Yeah, I think since the feds got called in, though, like before the feds were, before that person was hit in the face with like an impact munition from a federal agent, like I wouldn't say that the Justice Center had been as much of a flashpoint. Like they were kind of moving away from that because protesters weren't really getting anywhere in terms of getting a different reaction out of the police. Mm-hmm. But since then, I think it's like a tough line to walk, right? Because as much as you don't want to give, you know, credence or legitimacy to being attacked by federal agents, I think there's probably also a sense that you don't want to, you know, shirk away from what it means if you go along with it. And that actions by federal agents against people in the city of Portland take place outside of that context anyway. If you're wearing black, you're considered a protester and could be subjected to this kind of stuff.
Yeah, which is very dangerous, and it's very, you can't, that's so messed up. It's just
but also protesters aren't a monolith, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
It's a decentralized movement. It's not necessarily like one person is calling the shots and making this kind of call over and over again. There's not like one person or one organization that dictates how these protests are going to go.
Yes, and that's a huge, huge point because people are just organized. They, you know, it's like groups of friends. That is organized. You and two people, that's organizing. You and 500 people, that's organizing. You and your dog, that's organizing. You organize and you mobilize, and when you do it, you show up. That's what it is. That's what protesting is. It's you know, and you know what you're showing up for. You educate yourself. You take precautions, but you know, it isn't, you know, like I don't know if like this is something that people understand, again, like looking from the outside in, that it's not just, you know, Black Lives Matter is leading the parade. It's like, it's not like it's people are showing up in Southern Oregon. People are showing up in Eastern Oregon. People are just showing up outside of gas stations. I saw this one lady, sitting on a bus stop with a BLM sign, just sitting on a bus stop. Now she waiting for the bus and she has a sign up. She said, well, if I'm sitting down on my way for the bus, I might as well just show my face. I couldn't believe it. I was like, I couldn't believe it, you know? That's organizing, though. And it's absolutely everywhere. And it's, they just had an ingression too. And they, they were met with counter protesters. But you know what? They didn't like shoot each other in the face. That's a bit.
It's the same thing that Trump says about like, oh, Antifa are terrorists. It's like, well, the one person who's been involved in any kind of like Antifa organizing that has ever been injured, like he injured himself, And Antifa isn't an organization, it's an ideology, which is genuinely like kind of difficult to wrap your head around. But this idea of like strict organization or adhering to a particular set of beliefs or adhering to a particular group and that being the driving force isn't quite like descriptive of what it really looks like. And it does make it more complex. Like it is harder to digest when it's not like, hey, this is the one person who has organized this movement or who started this movement or who people really listen to about it. It's much more decentralized. I think that makes it harder to cover for the media, and from an outside perspective, it makes it harder to understand, you know, just the sheer breadth of reasons that people might be out on the street.
And it makes you realize why some journalists are using bombastic words like war zone in order to describe it. Meanwhile, other ones are, you know, more grassroots-led organizations and the media that they show and the resources that they share. It does not use words. No, it doesn't use like that. And it on the mainstream, it almost seems like the whole messaging of, you know, that started these protests are kind of getting drowned out by, by just not talking about it or just not, you know, like not having that be the front thing. It's just, you know, and meanwhile, like, you know, don't shoot PDX. It's, you know, I can't imagine like having all of this like stuff behind you and then like just kind of, you know, I just hope that like, you know, things don't repeat themselves and we do all of this and all of this destruction and all of this discomfort and like something I hope, you know, comes out of it that is going to be worth it, that we're going to look back and say, yep, it was worth it. It was hard. It was super hard. But look at us now. We're a better society for all that discomfort and, you know, growing pain. Mm-hmm. Oh, my. Yeah. I just realized it's almost 9 o'clock. Shh. It's time to wrap it up.
Yeah, we got to get going.
Althea, I appreciate you, like always. Sonia, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Sonia.
I guess we'll talk next week.
See you next time. Who run the world? Girls. 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 Who run the world? Girls.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Salem Progressive Film Series presentation of The Long and Twisted Tale of Jordan Cove LNG,